Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is the Compliance Guy.
The Compliance Guy.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is the Compliance Guy. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, happy Monday, everybody. It's been a couple of weeks since we have all been able to get together, although I just got to see my very good friend, Christine Hall, in person.
Hey,
in Honolulu last week. It was very nice to see her. She got to teach a session on the anatomy of a CPT code.
That was a lot of fun. It really was.
I hate that I missed it.
No, oh, I really do. Everywhere.
No, it was, I'm sure it was a fantastic session. It just, unfortunately, it conflicted with my schedule. And, you know, a schedule in Hawaii is a very tight schedule.
It was a great
conference, in all sincerity. There were tremendous presenters out there. I got the privilege and honor of getting to co-present the keynote with Ron Chapman, criminal defense attorney, who is absolutely fantastic. I think everybody really enjoyed his presentation and hearing, you know, directly from a criminal defense attorney who is in court almost on a weekly basis handling, you know, federal, civil and criminal cases tied to the False Claims Act and or the healthcare fraud statute. I know I learned a couple of new things that I was not aware of during his presentation. So with that said, I get to welcome Paul Spencer, Scott Kraft, Terry Fletcher, all to the round table, and to each and every single one of y'all tuning in, logging on and just hanging out with us for a little while. Thank y'all so much. So we have a pretty cool agenda for today. I think we have some very good topics that we want to get into and explore. And I'm going to start with you, Christine. We want to talk about the process of submitting clean claims and what does that actually mean? So let me kick it to you and we'll kind of go from there.
Well, I just wanted to remind folks that I heard a lot over the past couple of weeks of, well, we just send it out with this modifier and see if it works, or we'll add that if it doesn't work, or then we'll change that if it doesn't work. And I just wanted to remind everyone that we have an obligation to submit clean claims. And maybe you don't remember what that means, but it means that a claim that is free of errors, a claim that is, so you can't bill something out before that note has been authenticated, because that's not documentation yet. It hasn't been signed off. It hasn't been closed. It hasn't been authenticated. But the importance of making sure that we're taking a look at, like my present CPT code, looking at the CPT code itself, the requirements of it, looking for any indicators that belong to it, knowing your payer policy. You know, think about if you're a specialist's office, you may do 25 CPT codes on a regular basis. Why not know absolutely everything that needs to be known to get those codes processed correctly the first time on that clean claim? So that's where I wanted to kind of go with this early this morning, is just to talk a little bit about why we just don't throw things against the wall to see what sticks, why that raises red flags. Red flags cause audits. And if you look, some of the TPEs that are out there right now from the payers, and, oh, sorry, I said I'm having some audio problems on my end. I apologize. You hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you just fine.
Yeah, it's just your visual was melting a little bit, but that's okay.
Oh, my visual. That's okay.
Keep going. Didn't mean to interrupt you.
I am melty a little bit today. It was a long weekend of traveling, I'll tell you. No,
Hawaii,
just again,
poor girl.
I know.
Sorry. put that in there too. Just saying.
Right. But again, I just wanted to remind everyone, you know, it is our job when submitting that claim out to make sure it's a clean claim as it's going out the door. The audits are there responding to those people who just send something out and then send the same claim out again with a modifier and send it back out with different diagnosis and send it back out just to see if we can get this paid, rather than doing that process before we send the claim out.
Well, it's funny because
saves money.
I want to add to that, Christine, because yeah. I was recently at a practice and I thought this was amusing, not in a good way, but the claims, again, clean claim issues, just the data entry people just taking what they get and entering it without really making sure that the diagnosis links to the CPT code line item, that the modifiers are correct, that first of all, should it even be billed together? I mean, I know all of us deal with that. Should these line items go with that and so forth? And I know Sean and I are going to be talking on tomorrow on prior authorization, which is also a part of this. But one of the things I noticed on follow-up is sometimes in the, you know, the billers in the follow-up department, I've noticed that, and this is a specific office I was at, they didn't like what they were getting paid. So they looked at the EOB and they basically resubmitted the claim in paper and wrote on the paper and then mailed it to the insurance company, please pay me more. This is not acceptable. And I was like, wait, what? I said, you were already, you're already contracted for a certain amount of in reimbursement plus the patient's copay, deductible, whatever. I go, you know, post contract information, you can't now say, please pay me more. And they're just laughing at you at the other end. If they even look at your mail and go, okay, this is going right in the trash. So one of the things, clean claims too, is when you are submitting your claims, and I know Sean has had to deal with this, I think Paul might have to either, or two, is we used to have something called usual, reasonable, and necessary charges, which I don't think we really have that anymore. People base it on, you know, certain percentages of fee schedules. But I did notice that some of the inquiries we're getting from a legal position on claims submitted are on charges submitted if they're inflated too much. And so I have seen that. I have seen practices that charge like 800% of Medicare. And I'm like, whoa. And they said, well, we had this one payer that paid us that blah, blah, blah. I'm like, everything is about contract. I said, so unless it's Screen Actors Guild in California that pays what you bill, that's the only company that does, then, you know, don't assume that, you know, you're going to get that by inflating your, you know, your billed amount. So just in the clean claim sense, I see a lot of claims going out with, you know, they said, no, Terry, look at the claim. It's the right CPT, the right diagnosis. Then I go to look at it. Think of gastroenterology claim screenings, right? That turn into an actual procedure. So an endoscopy procedure. They don't put the screening code on it, or they put it on there, but they don't link the actual code for the polyp, the ICD-10, to the actual surgical procedure. They just put screening, screening, screening. And yes, that triggers benefits for the patients, but there's a reason why there's a section on the a claim form that says which number diagnosis goes with that line item. And I think clean claims, sometimes that's a big miss. So Paul, I'll throw it to you because I bet you see that a lot.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you made the point about inflated fee schedules. I once had a spinal neurosurgeon who decided that his best route for gaining additional reimbursement was to bill 10 times Medicare. So if you can imagine a spinal surgery at 10 times Medicare, what it does is it needlessly inflates your AR, and it just raises a larger and larger amount of services not covered on a particular charge. It's pointless, it's unscientific, and you need a better way to do that. As you know, the screening question is a good one, because sometimes you have a screening that, you know, particularly in the colonoscopy world, you have a screening for age that matriculates to a surgical, but that's, you know, actually in most cases, both of those diagnoses need to be on that one line item where it was a screening and then you have the polyp and then you have the surgical code. So at the very least, the benefits kick in, but it's important to know those things going forward. Most gastroenterological offices are pretty good at that. There are some that are still playing catch up as far as that goes.
Yeah. So, you know, and Scott, I'll come to you in just a moment because I know you got some good thoughts on this. You know, last week I took some time to put together what I felt were 10 areas of the revenue cycle that result in, if you do it right, it results in the ability to ensure that not only are your claims getting paid, but they're actually getting paid accurately, right? And the focus and the point that I wanted everybody to take away from this blog post that I did was, you know, ensuring, you know, timely processing and payment for your claims. So to Christine's point and to Terry's point, you know, it's critical to make sure that you gather accurate information. You know, the revenue cycle is not just a front and back end process. It's an entire process. It's beginning, middle, and end. If any portion of that revenue cycle is disrupted, it's going to create chaos. It's going to create a lag in payment times. It's going to create a problem with actually getting paid at all. So again, it's extremely important to make certain that, you know, from my perspective, and again, I'm going back to being a compliance officer, even though we're talking about operations, in my mind, I think it's absolutely critical to create policies and standard operating procedures for each and every single aspect of the revenue cycle. Why? Because it eliminates the what ifs. It eliminates the what do I do in this situation or that situation. So for me, again, if you haven't seen the blog post, I addressed accurate information. I addressed complete documentation, correct coding. I took on modifiers, timely filing, provider enrollment, which I got a lot of comments from people saying, oh my God, thank you for even thinking about enrollment as part of the revenue cycle. Compliance with local coverage determinations, local coverage articles, national coverage determinations, the use of electronic data interchange. And we're going to talk about EDI in just a little while, but billing integrity, making certain that we are tracking for fraud, waste, and abuse, or anything that could be perceived as fraud, waste, or abuse. And then finally, prompt responses to the request, which is the back end. And that goes to, I think, Terry, you brought up that point of, you know, a claim gets submitted, it gets denied, and all of a sudden people are just writing off the claim without understanding why the claim was denied. So, you know, it's extremely important to understand that as providers, you have responsibilities to ensure what you are submitting to an insurance company for remuneration is accurate. But more importantly, you have to also understand that the payers have very specific legal obligations to pay your claims in a timely period. It's called a Prompt Pay Act. And the federal law is 42 CFR 422.5. And then you have different sections for like managed care, you have for the federal payer programs, and then if you do a search by state, you will find that the majority of states actually have a prompt pay law that says, like, for example, I'm in Georgia. In the state of Georgia, an insurance company has 15 days to process a clean claim. 15 days. So keep that in mind.
45 right. In California.
Yeah. There
but
you go.
The one thing that go you ahead. Mentioned, Sean, I just wanted to quick before we go to Scott, please. Is that you said something about, you know, making sure that, and I think I just lost my train of thought. When we talk about the clean claims and making sure things are submitted correctly, I noticed that, here's what it was. You said something about, you know, people are just writing it off, which I mentioned before. Remember to read your EOBs, okay? You can't just write off everything. First of all, you should be very familiar with your fee schedules. I did an audit for a practice last year that their contract, they're supposed to get paid for 99214's 145.18, and they were getting paid 125.18, and nobody checked. So they were losing $20 a patient, and I was just comparing things and looking. I said, wow, that's low. That's lower than what we were getting on their Medicare payer. And then I looked at their contract, which was amazing we even had it, and I said, hey, you're losing $20 on each one of these. And they're like, oh, you know, it's fine. We got paid. And I think a lot of people in practices, a lot of people in the revenue cycle management, they don't really, they post payments without looking at the EOB. And or the attachment, the remittance advice. And the reason I say that is, remember, just because it says that it's not covered doesn't mean it couldn't be patient responsibility. So if you're going to bill something and it may not be covered, it's not bundled, it's not included in the primary procedure, it just says this is not something we cover, they sometimes will say that's the patient responsibility. And if you try to write that off, oh man, you're opening up another can of worms, because that could be considered a Stark II violation, or incentivizing a patient to stay in your practice and giving them cash in their pocket to stay. So you can't do that either. So the clean claims, as Sean mentioned, it starts, you know, getting authorization to do it and getting the information. Let's even start before that. The patient coming in the office and making sure you have the correct demographics, insurance card, all that, all the way to the end and the payment process. And it's really crazy about, you know, what's happening when you see how things are posted. And some of the feedback I get sometimes is, well, that's never covered, so we just bill it and write it off. And I'm just like, oh my gosh. So Sean or Scott, I know you haven't had a chance to chime in on this. So your thoughts?
I kind of want to take a step back to what Christine said
about
knowing
the auto posting.
I wanted to start. I don't know. I'm having some technical issues. But
go ahead, Scott. It's on Christine. We got you. Go ahead, buddy.
Okay. Yeah. So I wanted to go back to what Christine said about understanding the rules behind the services that you bill most commonly. And I think that's really important throughout all of this, because we talked about this idea of like trial and error is kind of where we started, right? Like, I'm going to put things on claims, but I don't necessarily understand. And I think it leads to a handful of things. One, you may be billing something incorrectly and being paid for it. Two, you may be billing something incorrectly that the payer is supposed to flag, but they're not flagging it. Sean and I have been involved in cases like that before, where the payer is paying something that goes against their own policies, that error is readily knowable if you look at the claim. It's not a documentation issue. The payer's paying for it anyway, and then they're coming back and they're saying, oh, we made a mistake. We paid for this inadvertently. And by the way, you owe us a bunch of money, right? So it allows these errors to persist. I think in addition, it causes misalignment within your organization. So, you know, I worked on a project recently. Paul helped me a little bit with that project, where it was pretty clear from the documentation that there was misalignment throughout the organization, from the provider to the biller, up through administration, about the core services that this provider was doing. And so the result of that was that nobody was educating the provider about the specifics of the intent behind the procedures that he was documenting. He was assigning codes that he wasn't correctly describing in the documentation. He was assigning codes that were not billable within the construct of the specific surgical encounter, but may have been billable had we known a little bit more about the specifics of the encounter. And so it became a sort of, as we talked about, right, we're kind of throwing spaghetti at the wall and we're not being thoughtful about what the primary services are that we're doing. And then the last thing I want to say about that, as it relates to, you know, things like modifiers and truly understanding how modifiers work. So when you think about G2211, the new code for the longitudinal relationship, there's a specific exception as described in the CMS policy that if you are assigning modifier 25 to the E&M service, then you can't use G2211. But what if you're assigning modifier 25 when you do not need to assign it? And consequently, that lack of knowledge or understanding is resulting in a potential missed opportunity. So, you know, that's obviously I ticked through a few different things, but I think, you know, Christine's point was probably, to me at least, the foundation of this conversation, right? Like, if these are the core services of your business in a way, then you should know with precision how they're done, how they're documented, what the rules are that are behind them, you know. And then look, you're going to have some outlier services that maybe you don't do that often that you need to focus on when you do them. But I think it will result in generally more correct frontline billings. It's rather than letting the system kind of correct you, which I think is somewhat fraught with peril.
Yeah, I think those are all great points. All right. So I think, is everybody pretty comfortable with talking about the clean claim filing process and really what practices need to be doing? Is there anything that you feel we may have overlooked?
Well, I think it transitions into our next talking point very well, going back to Terry's point about, you know, sometimes you're lucky to get a claim paid. Right now, we have commercial insurance carriers who are now using the power of artificial intelligence in order to deny claims en masse. You know, so in most practices, knowing that there is a rather reactionary processing system on the part of insurance carriers that basically says we're going to deny a percentage of claims just because and see what happens. There's a thought that, well, it's a miracle that I just got paid at all. So let's just take that payment and quietly move on about our business and let's not look at that. But if you're not really looking at the fine print about how and why that claim was paid, particularly when you are dealing with services where a modifier is utilized, you're doing yourself a tremendous disservice, and it could come back to bite you based on the post-payment audit arena that we, Sean and I, find ourselves in every single day.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see that. You know, I was gonna talk about Change Healthcare next, but I want to stay kind of on the theme that we're on right now, Paul. And you had mentioned a topic that I think fits right into this whole clean claims processing, and that is misapplication of diagnosis codes and the problems that we are all continuing to see from coders, billers, providers. So let's kind of talk a little bit about what you're seeing as the problem. Let's try to identify what the root cause of these problems are, and then let's talk about, you know, what a proper solution would be for this.
Okay. So I have to give credit to my colleagues today who kind of put this ball on the tee, mentioning, you know, just correct diagnosis assignment on CPT codes. But with the changes in E&M guidelines back on January 1st, 2021, we have another issue that's kind of rearing its head. And that issue is listing diagnosis codes within your assessment and plan that weren't meaningfully assessed during the encounter. I had a good example recently of a physician who specializes in weight loss medicine. And realistically, the reason why that patient is coming in is they are looking for weight loss guidance. He is focusing on best practices for that patient to lose weight. And you know, what he was also listing in his assessment and plan were chronic conditions that should be taken into account when you're dealing with a patient who has weight loss issues, such as diabetes and hypertension. But he is not the primary care physician, and he is not really, he's not prescribing medication. He's not making any changes to the treatment regimen for those conditions. He basically is taking them into account when looking over the entirety of the patient's weight loss regimen. So it's very, you know, so in those particular cases, he really should be listing the fact that the patient is either overweight, has obesity or morbid obesity, and listing the body mass index, ICD-10 code. And also should be understanding what commercial insurance is going to pay in that situation. But it becomes very important, particularly if you're choosing a higher level of E&M service based on the fact that you believe you're contributing to the direct care of multiple chronic illnesses, that your documentation reflect that, and that there needs to be a meaningful assessment. Even though we say medically appropriate history and medically appropriate examination, it would be hoped that if you are listing a condition within your assessment and plan, that the history and examination documentation that you bring forth in that E&M encounter shows that there has been an assessment that can meaningfully be tied to that condition before reporting it on a claim. And this has enormous ramifications, particularly we now have Medicare Advantage payment rates that were just recommended to be cut significantly. So you know for a fact that Medicare Advantage carriers are going to come back and say, we have to have the most specific diagnosis codes to the utmost specificity in order for us to be credited for that, so we can keep getting our 30 pieces of silver from the federal government for being a Medicare Advantage plan.
Let me ask you this question, Paul, and I'll open this to the panel as well. So while I was in while I was at the AMBA conference last week, I had a very nice gentleman come up to me and he said, hey, question for you. HCC codes. Should we as the practice be auditing HCC codes? Is it really up to us to make sure that the codes that we're reporting to the insurance companies are accurate? And my initial reaction was, well, yes. Now, HCCs, now help me and make sure I'm correct on this. HCCs don't necessarily impact the remuneration for a provider, but they are critical to the fees, the administrative processing fees that an insurance company charges to Medicare for third-party administration of their claims. So, you know, and then the second part to the question, I know I'm giving you two parts, but think about this. My answer changed a little more when he gave me the second part. He said, well, you know, our group is also, we have our own ACO. And right then and there, I said, well, definitively, you have got to audit your HCCs, because as an ACO, depending on the type of compensation that you're receiving for it, right, under MIPS or MACRA, you know, you've got to make sure that you're hitting all of these quality measures and these diagnoses tie into that. Look, I'm not a diagnosis guru. You know, I spend the majority of my time focusing, obviously, on, you know, the fraud, waste, and abuse and the statutes, acts, laws, and, you know, those other things. I rely on you all. And that's one of the things that I talked about at the conference. And I see Pam Vanderbilt is on here, who, it was so nice to see Pam out in Hawaii as well. But, you know, one of the things that I tell people all the time is you have got to surround yourself with a group of trusted resources. Because again, I don't want to be the diagnosis guru. I want to be able to rely on the Terry Fletchers, the Christine Halls, the Stephanie Allards, the Paul Spencers, the Scott Crafts, the Sonal Patels, the people in that world who I know do this coding every single day. Yeah, I have these credentials, and yes, I earn them and I maintain them, but I am not that guru. So I want to turn it over to you guys to talk about how important is it, because we're talking about misapplication of diagnosis codes. How important is it for practices to, as part of their annual audit plan or quarterly audit plan, to make sure that they are auditing these hierarchical coding conventions, these HCCs?
Before Paul answers that, if you don't mind, Paul, I just want to comment on something Paul said prior to that, because HCCs gets into another realm and a whole kind of different thing. But one of the things that Paul was talking about, as far as, and we actually, all of us were talking about it too, as far as linking diagnoses and, you know, reflecting what's in the actual chart. One of the things that I think gets missed, and this is probably one of the hardest concepts for practices to understand, in my opinion, when it comes to ICD-10 coding and compliance, is that there's a difference between putting a code, an ICD-10 code, on a claim form that is active or that you find in the medical record for today's encounter, something that you're treating today that you are putting for that data service, versus putting an ICD-10 code on a claim because you know it's covered for money. And I see people do that. They pull up their local coverage decisions, determinations, or they pull up the payer policy and they say, okay, well, this diagnosis is covered. It's not really on the medical record and we haven't done anything to find it, but I know I'm going to get paid if I use this diagnosis. And that's what the payer is telling me to use this diagnosis. That's their thought process. I'm like, yeah, but you don't, the patient doesn't have that diagnosis. I've seen it done with cancer. And I'm just like, you've got to be kidding me. And so, yeah, and trust me, Scott, I know it's funny, but not funny. Right. And I, you know, people come in and they've got other disorders of a breast mass, or they've got a you know, an unspecified breast mass. There's no cancer found. And they're like, yes, but cancer gets paid. I'm like, people, I want to go, dudes, what are you doing? The most recent one is I had an outpatient hospital where a patient presented with a TIA and they did a CT scan and they also did an MRI. Well, the MRI was denied because this payer only paid for stroke. And they said, okay, well, we'll just put stroke on there. I'm like, no, you can't just put something on there for payment. They're like, no, it's fine. We can. I said, have you read the ICD-10 guidelines? When you have a suspected or possible diagnosis on inpatient only, inpatient and critical care and hospitalists, they can actually put those diagnoses on. But on outpatient, no, you can't do that. And so it just, I think we get caught up in coding for money instead of representing what was actually done and what we can support in the medical record as far as that ICD-10 code. And it, you know, it's payer policy versus reality of what the patient has. And again, be careful when you're doing something for money, because how many times have we said, you know, follow the money and you'll find the fraud. Mm-hmm. You know, well, I see Taylor King has something on here. She says recently had a provider say that obesity isn't covered. So they select abnormal weight gain. And, and she's like, but it's not abnormal. And I'm okay. Like, exactly, Taylor. I'm like, please don't select something that isn't part of the doctor's thought process just because it gets you paid. So I'm sorry. I'll
I had abnormal weight gain after last week. I had too many poke bowls and
Moco. So it's time for some visual aids. Okay. I need to remind people, this is the ICD-10 code book. And it you know, there are over 140,000 codes if you combine ICD-10 and ICD-10 PCS. And it's only this big for one reason. If there wasn't an actuarial reason to build a code set like this, because we got insurance carrier input when we were building ICD-10, which took about 20 years more than any other civilized healthcare system in the world. If there wasn't an actuarial reason for a code to be in this book, it wouldn't be there. And so when you're choosing a diagnosis code that pays, you know, I'm telling you that somewhere down the road, and we've already seen a variation on a theme with this, the reason why the ICD-10 is that big is that some actuary somewhere is looking at a diagnosis code and saying, we are seeing this diagnosis code being used for a large patient population in this area. And as a result, you know, insurance premiums are going to go up in this area because we are reporting, we are seeing the reporting of that diagnosis code in that area. You know, it's very important to remember that. It's a much different system in the rest of the civilized world because they're really just looking at disease reporting and epidemiology from a public health standpoint, where the insurance industry in this country, because of our payment model, basically says we are looking at these diagnosis codes from a revenue standpoint and what we can do in the future to be able to restrict revenue based on the fact that these people have this illness in this area and we're going to raise rates because of it.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things too, Paul, is you've mentioned diabetes. It gets slapped on everything. And I have providers that do that too. And I said, okay, for example, a spine physician, he wants to do a spine surgery on a patient. He put diabetes, you know, the spine doctor's not following them for diabetes. And I said, however, diabetic patients tend to be slower to recover. There tends to be some interactions when it comes to possible sedation issues that you're going to have to deal with because of the medications they're on. There's the comorbidity of diabetes could affect what that orthopedic surgeon is going to do. But unless they document it, I don't want to see it. You're going to have to correlate what you're doing as far as on the claim. And as a secondary diagnosis in the chart, that's fine.
What drives me nuts is that we are the only country in the world that uses diagnoses to drive reimbursement.
It's really unfortunate. Aren't we the only country that you can only really get good insurance if it's through your employer? I mean, I'm now having to purchase it myself and it sucks and it's more expensive than it ever has been. Well, so Scott, I didn't mean to shut you out. Yeah. I know you're still trying.
Yeah. Two quick points before I throw it to Scott, the best systems in the world are ones that went last. So you're looking at Taiwan and Australia who have a mix of government plans and private plans, you know, the people who went first, I mean, you're better off living in a refrigerator box under a bridge and going into a long-term care facility in England. The second thing with regard to diagnosis assignment, before I throw it to Scott, I mean, I want to go back to Sean's point about the payment model making all the difference, because I have dealt with practices who are in an ACO who are very much on top of their diagnosis reporting and their diagnosis documentation. I know of one practice in Florida where the medical director basically retired from the practice of medicine so he could be the documentation guru for the rest of the practice. And it has had a very salutary effect on their bottom line based on the fact that they're in an ACO and they all have risk-based contracts. And they tend to be the first primary care provider of choice when a plan shuts down and suddenly there are lives that need medical care. And they're looking for people who have the best risk data and the best outcomes with their patient population. So very important.
Now, I was going to point out that, you know, we were talking about, Paul, when you held up the book and the volume of our diagnosis codes, we have a diagnosis code W5801XA for bitten by alligator, which is probably not using a lot in like England or the Netherlands. But on a serious note, Pam started to go down this path and she can correct me if I'm misconstruing some of what she's saying, but I think, you know, this is all of, again, a physician or provider's thought process, right? Like, is the provider thinking that diabetes is impacting his or her treatment of the patient, or is it not at all? And they don't, you know, it's never their intent to code it, right? And so one of the things that I'm seeing more and more of with the diagnosis coding that's a little concerning to me is the payer is pushing through to the provider. So we talked about before with the HCCs, on a given claim, you as the provider don't really get paid any more money if you're assigning these additional diagnosis codes. I mean, there's a conversation about whether it's a level 3 or a level 4, but like you set that to the side for a second. This is additional money for the plans based on the severity of the patient. So, you know, I'm seeing instances where the payer is going to the provider and pushing the provider. Well, why aren't you assessing the diabetes? Why aren't you, you know, diagnosing this on the claim? And the provider's saying, well, it has nothing to do with what I'm managing, right? The provider's making a reasonable clinical determination that diabetes has nothing to do with what they're treating today. So they don't want to do anything with it, right? And so, you know, this is becoming more complicated on all sides around the premise that we just talked about, tying the reimbursement or tying the finance of the health system into the diagnosis coding and figuring out who has the perverse incentives. Because I've said this on the podcast before, you know, and again, I'll almost relate it to what I said earlier today. You want to know the core diagnosis codes and what your providers are managing and what their intent is. Because if the plan is pushing you to put certain diagnosis codes on claims, and that's not withstanding later scrutiny, you know, the plan is going to be like, poof, they're going to be gone. And be like, I don't know what this provider did. They didn't, you know, the rule is you're supposed to assess it, right? And so I do think it's important that the provider's thought process, when I think about provider education, I find myself saying that more and more with diagnosis codes. Like, this is your thought process, right? Like, if you're telling me that you put diabetes on here because it impacted what you're treating, but you didn't document it, that's why I'm taking it off. So if your thought process include it, if it doesn't have anything to do with it, then don't assign it, right? You're kind of at that fork in the road. And the goal is to match, to me, the provider's thought process and what they're treating.
Those are such great points, Scott. All right. Let's move to our last topic. And this one's interesting. Because I feel like there's really a conflict of interest here, and I wouldn't be surprised to see the Justice Department kind of take this one up a little bit further down the road. I'm talking about the Change Healthcare issue. By now, I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast, everybody who works in healthcare, has had some run-in with Change Healthcare at some point. Change Healthcare is owned by United Healthcare. And what happened a few weeks back is that hackers working for an organization called Black Cat Ransom, and they actually call themselves the Black Cat Ransomware Gang, were actually behind the attack themselves. And the cyber attack resulted in this group stealing 6 terabytes. Okay, just process that for a minute. 6 terabytes worth of data from Change Healthcare. And this included medical records, patient social security numbers, and information on active military personnel. What's interesting is that there is a published FBI report. It's the FBI's annual Internet Crime Report. And it confirmed that $22 million had been paid to Black Cat for the cyber attack. And we're presuming that Change Healthcare or its parent company, United Healthcare, paid the $22 million or the majority of the demand from Black Cat. You know, the thing that you have to ask yourself is, how did this happen to an organization the size of Change? We all know that the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act has been out there since 1996. We know that we've seen the high tech rule. We've seen, you know, all of these different certifications that have come along for SOC 1, SOC 2 certification, all of these exorbitant costing programs. I can tell you, for our AI software program that we used to own, CRA, Compliance Risk Analyzer, the amount of security protocols that we had to go through, the number of people that were sitting and writing patches for these hackers around the world. You know, it's just incredible. And, you know, it's actually funny. And I put this up here because we may laugh at this, but the fact is, these are probably 13-year-old kids around the world that are just these computer gurus who have learned sequencing and coding and all of these different measures to be able to hack into these systems. Think about this. The Dark Overlord, if I'm not mistaken, that was their name, that hacked into Coca-Cola and to Disney and Delta and all these Fortune 500 companies. Well, this cyber attack, okay, and as I said, it has led to the theft of 6 terabytes of information. It's an infinite amount of information. I'm sure every single person listening to this podcast, your information is contained in that 6 terabytes. If you've ever been to a doctor, I'm sure your information's contained in there. But the what has happened is all of these medical practices, these hospitals, these health systems, I have clients that are reaching out to me saying, Sean, I've not seen payment in 7 weeks now. We've had to resort to putting everything onto paper claims. What do we do? How do we handle this? What kind of guidance should we expect from Change Healthcare? What is United Healthcare doing? Well, United put out a response. It's an interesting response, and I will post it to LinkedIn here in just a couple of moments. That's sort of their FAQ page and the what ifs, ands, and buts to this cybersecurity attack. So let me pause there because I know Scott, Paul, Terry, y'all have had some experience with clients reaching out as well saying, hey, what do I do? How do we handle this? Where do we go from here? Anybody want to jump in and take it? I mean, I feel like I'm in the middle of the ocean right now, and I just threw out my
line,
and I'm waiting for somebody
to say something, and I'll send it to Scott.
All right.
I think the one thing that's tough is a lot of people don't know what happened, and Change Healthcare, I think, was an intermediary, or is, to help facilitate claims payments, and there was a lot of payments that weren't paid because of a breach, correct? I think I'm correct in a lot of that, but the thing that I think people miss is that the, what is it? 4 billion profitable United Healthcare owns it or is tied to it.
Yes.
And then the government is out there saying, well, we're going to help this and help that. Why? If this is owned by another company, that company who is ultra profitable needs to be the one responsible to fix it. And I think a lot of this is a lesson, not just in cybersecurity, but in trusting the third party vendors that we have and having a backup plan. And I think that a lot of practices, they just didn't have a backup. They didn't know what to do once this happened. They didn't know who to go to. They couldn't call because when they called, they were either the call was dropped or the lines were busy because everybody was calling. And, you know, I think when you have such a huge breach in trust, and then it's, again, tied to money. And for millions of members that had to deal with this, it wasn't just thousands. They had quite a bit tied to this breach that I think that the providers are kind of stuck with now. Who do we trust? Do we just go with another third party vendor? Do we trust the government's going to fix it? Who's going to come to our rescue?
Yeah, you know, several have moved to different clearinghouses. That was the option. So remember, Change Healthcare was McKesson. Right. So McKesson sold Change to United Healthcare. This was a $2.8 billion transaction. McKesson received $1.25 billion of this transaction. Shareholders received another $1.75 billion. And the rest of the proceeds that were received from United Healthcare actually went to paying down the debt that Change had accrued.
But Sean, the biggest problem for physicians here, and I think Pam's also outlining it in her comments, is that a lot of the softwares like AdvancedMD, I know NextGen had it.
Yep.
This is their proprietary, if there's another better way, or this who they use as their clearinghouse. And so when your one vendor only uses another vendor, you know, exclusively, you're kind of screwed there. Then what do you do? Because you're relying on the first tier vendor. So Scott, what have you dealt with this?
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of great solutions here, right? I mean, I think the problem, I think our government in some ways, needs to be a little bit more proactive about ensuring, one, that these conflicts do not exist, right? Because there's very little recourse for a lot of our core listeners, right? You're sort of stuck in this universe where, as Pam says, it's like the pharmacy, the clearinghouse, the providers, and these companies have the money to fund or bridge some of these payment gaps, but instead they're kind of pointing to the government and saying, well, you should advance money to solve this problem. And, you know, look, I think we kind of joke around about it being like a 13-year-old kid in their family's basement or whatever. I think in reality, there's a very sophisticated organizations that function out of, you know, China, Russia, North Korea. You know, these are not, you know, these are not, I think, teenagers as much as we joke about that. And, you know, I have a friend who works for a small nonprofit back east. And it was kind of interesting as all this was going on. Like, she sent me a random note on Friday and she's like, well, I'm off today because our little system got like hijacked and they're asking for like a ransom. And, you know, that we can't get into our email. We can't do, and she works sort of tangentially in healthcare. I won't say more about that, but they can't do their client facing work. They're essentially stuck, you know, and so this happens to businesses large and small. And so, you know, look, as a practical matter, like I say, I mean, I think our country needs to figure out how to solve these problems because they perpetually are occurring. I also think, you know, I took my HIPAA, my annual HIPAA compliance certification through DM last week. And, you know, we kind of go through those questions and they're always a little silly, right? Where it's like a multiple choice question. And it's like, somebody's asking for this EPHI, what should I do? But you really need to be thoughtful within your own organization about the emails that you're opening, you know, the links that you're clicking on. You know, a lot of this stuff is happening because these hackers are coming right through the front door because somebody's clicking on something or doing something that they're not supposed to be doing. So, I mean, I'd say a couple of things, right? Like, I wish I had better, you know, guidance other than trying to find the, you know, diversity of clearinghouses, having options to keep your payments going. I do think within your own organization, you need to be very smart about how you address cybersecurity, because this is really just, I think, the tip of the spear. And, I think that these organizations are trying to infiltrate, you know, any type of healthcare organization, large and small. And one of the things I've read about a few times, as I'm sure many people have on the podcast today, is that for every, you know, Change Healthcare you hear about, there are companies that are so embarrassed by this that they just pay the money and it goes away and you never hear about it. So, you know, to me, I would obviously be very worried about Change Healthcare, but I'd also be thoughtful about this is something that's just going to keep happening. And, you know, there's things that you can't control, but there's also things within your organization that you can control. But definitely be thoughtful about that.
Yeah. And another issue is trying to do cybersecurity on the cheap. I mean, the guy who's connecting your servers and the guy who runs your phone system may not be the best guy to deal with, you know, cybersecurity for your financial transactions or your electronic medical record or things of that nature. You know, don't spread those tech people too thin. And if you only have one, invest in two. If it hasn't become completely clear in the last 18 months with things like this hack, and there was another hack of a small hospital about 50 miles west of Chicago, where that rural hospital that was focused on treating people who weren't particularly close to a major healthcare infrastructure in their area, that hospital had to shut down. They made the calculation that it was cheaper to shut down than pay the ransom. And now people are don't even have the choice to make, make that medical provider their main medical provider in their area. It causes great inconvenience to that patient population to try and find care elsewhere. All the points that Scott made about, not opening the wrong email or not sharing your password with people, all very good points. But you also have to make certain that you're making an investment in those systems, because it is crystal clear to me that major hacking groups see healthcare systems as low-hanging fruit, particularly healthcare systems that that are in small and very easy to take advantage of.
Well, and I think your comment about the resourcing is incredibly important, because, you know, one of the reasons that I don't think these are necessarily teenagers is they tend to know what to ask for. Like, they know the size of the organization that they've gotten into, you know, and they know they're going to ask for something that's going to hurt, but is generally doable. And I've read a few things about some of these organizations, and it's shocking how it's almost like they have a customer service department. Like, it was just, it's fascinating to read about. I mean, what's happening is horrible, but it just goes to show you that, yeah, I mean, you need to treat e-security as a priority, right? So it's not just so much giving people like a HIPAA quiz every year, although I think that's important too, but making sure, like, are people locking their systems when they go away? You know, what are we doing to, like, both try to sequester email flow, but then, you know, enforce it? You know, I work with organizations where they send test emails to people all the time, you know, where they're kind of spammy and they see who clicks on it as a means for education. And you really need to be hyper vigilant about those types of things, I think.
Well, I think, Scott, too, people forget about virtual workers and what they're doing from home, who also have access to remote access into their system.
And that's one of the first questions I ask when we talk about remote work and the clients I work with is, like, whose equipment is your work being done on? Is it always your equipment? If you have a remote worker, can they take out their own laptop and log into something? Like, how do you, you know, manage that in terms of, you know, if they download a bunch of games or any of that stuff? And you know, it's something that we just have to be cognizant about, because different people are educated at different levels. Like, I go visit my dad, he's 80, turn on his computer, it's like fireworks of pop-ups for like 20 minutes, because God only knows what he clicks on, right? And so when you're training people to work in these environments, there really needs to be a focused training on that.
Did you know there's still education. Did you know there's still a dial-up for AOL? I found that out. Yeah. You remember that sound it used to make? Ding, ding, ding. You know, I don't know, in somebody's house the other day. I'm like, I know that sound. And they're like, oh, yeah, sorry, we still do dial-up. I go, they still have dial-up?
They're still landlines?
And I had to part with my BlackBerry for an iPhone. I want my BlackBerry back if there's still dial-up.
Okay. You just brought up something that is such a sore subject for me.
Oh, no. The fact that I have AOL still.
Well, no, that's hysterical. I didn't know that they still had landlines. The BlackBerry.
I love my BlackBerry.
The BlackBerry was the single greatest invention.
I loved it. I was so sad to have to go to an iPhone. But I don't like the touch
screen. I didn't like the black one. That had all kinds of issues. I liked the silver one that they came out with. And the trackpad and oh my God.
I could feel my numbers. I know.
Yes.
Oh, I just wanted to say something about, you posted something for the Change Healthcare. It's in the feed, everyone. But I want you to, this is to the listeners, I want you to also be cognizant of the fact that it's a marketing ploy for them to say, we're closer to bringing this back online, just so you know. They're going to continue to say that unless you keep hammering them. When is that happening? And get with your congressman. Make sure you're saying something to your senators, because they will just let this go as long as you let them. And time flies. Yeah, and all of a sudden you'll realize a couple
years. I don't think this one's going to be let go. I really don't. I think this one, because it's a multi-billion-dollar corporation, I think where UHC has had their issues before and having to pay $350 million settlements in the past, I do not believe OCR is going to walk away from this one. This could be the biggest payday for OCR ever. I do believe there's going to be, if there's not already, behind the scenes conversations happening right now. The director at OCR, he is a very uber aggressive individual. He's looking for the big fish, and I think he's about to land a whale. Yeah. So,
well, one last point I want to make, because I know that we're close to the end of time. I mean, what I tend to think about here with UHC basically being the owner of Change Healthcare, where does this bleed into Medicare administrative contractors and the fact that we have major, insurance carriers who are handling Medicare data every single day as part of their normal claims processes? And now here is one of those companies who not only have Medicare Advantage information within their claims universe, but what does this mean for every other MAC and the way they transact claims, and how good is their security? And, you know, it better be a wake up call in the C-suites of these Medicare administrative carriers to get on the ball and really concentrate on security and make it stronger than it even is today, in the absence of a MAC hack thus far.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, that's going to bring us right to the end of this Monday auditing, coding, and compliance roundtable. We lost our good friend along the way, Christine Hall. We sure hate that because she is such a valuable contributor to this panel discussion, but she was having difficulty with her internet. I guess she's still one of those using dial-up AOL. I don't know. But I want to thank Paul Spencer, Scott Kraft, Terry Fletcher, and for the few minutes that Christine was able to join us. Great conversation today. Great dialogue. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with a brand new code auditing, coding, and compliance roundtable. Terry and I are going to be back tomorrow with a hashtag Terry Tuesday episode. We're going to be talking about prior authorizations. Sure, we'll talk about some other stuff that is non-related, and probably I'll find a way to drive Terry crazy to the point where she tells me to shut up and let's start talking about what we need to talk about. But until then, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media at The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.